Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
We understand what it means. Mark has, who do men say that I am? Matthew has, who do men say the Son of Man is? And I think every time Jesus used the word Son of Man, we could almost put the pronoun I in there. He's speaking about himself. But why did he choose a title like Son of Man? Why not something more familiar? Nobody had ever been called this except one prophet and one oblique reference in the Old Testament. Well, as you know, a little later, Jesus tells them not to tell anybody that he is the Christ. And, of course, the word Christ is the Greek word for the word Hebrew word Messiah, which means anointed one. Jesus had a problem. He knew that he was the anointed one. And he also knew that the popular conceptions of who he was in his day were false. And so he had to choose a title that had no nationalistic, no political implications. And he chose the term Son of Man. Now, it's hard for us who speak English to understand another language unless we speak other languages. But this term is not as striking in the Aramaic that Jesus spoke as it seems to us. It seems very offhand. It seems a very strange thing to call yourself the Son of Man. But in Aramaic, they didn't have a whole lot of adjectives. There wasn't a big red balloon. They would say the balloon was the son of bigness and the son of redness. And they used to describe things by calling something the son of something. So what Jesus was saying is, it's the word that means I am a son of man. And it simply meant like I am a man. Matter of fact, to an English-speaking group, probably, who do men say I am, humanly speaking, is what he's talking about. So we need to look in the Old Testament to see exactly what possibilities there were for this term in the Old Testament. I read two chapters out of Ezekiel this morning. I read 33 and 34. What does God call Ezekiel in that book? Son of Man. Now, he's not calling him the Messiah, is he? No, he's simply saying, fella, stand up. I want to talk to you. Mister, I want to say something to you. So it's just a word that means human. But there's another reference in the Old Testament for the use of the word Son of Man. It's found in that beautiful passage in Daniel chapter 7, verse 13, where the Ancient of Days comes and sits on his throne, and thrones are set up, and one like unto the Son of Man comes on the clouds of heaven. In my exegesis of Daniel chapter 7, historically, I think that title, the Son of Man, in Daniel 7, also refers to humanity. I don't think it had any conjectures of a superhuman divine personage in Daniel 7. But it came to mean that. As the Jews discussed these messianic texts, some of the Psalms, some particular kind of references in the Old Testament to the coming Messiah, and began to link it with the divinic throne, this thing in Daniel 7:13 began to take on fuller meaning, or meaning of someone more than human. So I think that Jesus used this title because it meant simply man or human, but there was a flicker, a trace, a glimpse, a tradition, a precedent to the fact that it also meant something more. And he never gets into the something more until much later in his ministry. But right now, he's talking to himself by that title. Now, notice if you would, where they're going to answer him what people have been telling him. Now, these are things that they had picked up from the crowds, or overhearing conversations, or talking with people themselves. And the first one they say is, they think you're John the Baptist. Well, that's a strange thing, because John the Baptist and Jesus were contemporaries. And they were both alive at the same time, and everybody should have known that. But they didn't. This is really a reference to what Herod Antipas thought he was. Mark 6:16. Herod thought that Jesus was John the Baptist risen from the dead. So this is a particular thing. I don't think all the people thought this, because many of the people knew that John is the one who baptized Jesus. There was, you know, stories going around about the baptism and all in Jesus' day. So I think this is particularly Herod's view. Well, what about when they say, others say, you're Elijah? Well, where do they get this from? Well, they get it from the closing book of the Old Testament. Malachi chapter 4, verse 5 says that God is going to send Elijah the prophet before the great and terrible day of the Lord. Elijah is the one who would prepare the way of the Lord, the Messiah, to come. So this is a very honorific title. They are saying, you really are God's man. You really are someone special. You really are a very important religious person, by saying he was Elijah. Now, Matthew adds that some thought he was Jeremiah. Exactly what characteristic of these prophets, we don't know. Elijah was known for his miracles. Jeremiah known for his weeping. It may have been that different aspects of Jesus' ministry brought these particular prophets to mind. And others said he is just one more of the prophets. Now, if you look at Luke 9:19, you'll see that every one of these references infers, implies, is based on the fact that Jesus is some great person that has been raised from the dead. Every one of these views represent or assume resurrection. Now, they are saying about Jesus, you are somebody special. You are some great man raised from the dead. You really are a significant person, these views. But as I've told you before, Jesus is not content to be a great person or a good man or the greatest man ever born. There's more to him than greatness as far as man is concerned. And so he wants to find out, he wants to get the conversation going and talk to them in the line of who he really is. So after this set of questions and these different persons put forward, Jesus began to ask them, who do you say I am? That's very important to me because of the importance this chapter has been in Roman Catholicism, that we understand that the you that Jesus refers to is not a singular you. In English, you know, plural and singular, second person are the same word. But this is the plural you. Jesus is asking the entire body of disciples. Now, Peter's going to speak for the entire group, okay? The question is oriented not toward Peter, but toward the group. Who do you, plural, you yourselves, say that I am? Peter spoke up, as usual, and answered him, you are the what? Okay, now you tell me, is Christ a title or a name? It is a title. Hardy Clements and I are real good friends, and I really like some of his commercials. I get tickled at him sometimes, the way he says things. And this deal about we serve Jesus the Christ. Well, we always... Jesus the Christ is exactly, it is Jesus, the anointed one of God. But you see, this word came to mean a title. That's why Paul begins to use Jesus Christ as a full title. It's not yet a title in the Gospels. It will be by Paul's time. I mean, be a name. It's a title here. It becomes a name. Now, it means someone especially anointed with God's Spirit to accomplish God's purpose. Guess who else in the Old Testament is called God's anointed? Cyrus, the heathen, the ruler of, I forgot what country. What country is that? It's not Babylon. Yeah. Medo-Persian, right? I think it's what it is. Anyway, I don't believe Cyrus was a believer. He let the Jews go back home after the exile, but I don't think he was a believer. But God used him and called him my anointed. Also in the Old Testament, we know that the high priest was anointed, going back to Aaron. One or two times a prophet was anointed. Not very often, but every now and then, a couple of times, a prophet's anointed. And the king of Israel was anointed as a sign that he was representative of God for the people. So, somehow, in Jesus Christ, I think, we have a culmination of all these aspects of the Old Testament. That's why we often talk about Jesus being prophet, priest, and king, who fulfills all the offices in the Old Testament of people who were anointed, and he becomes, in a supreme sense, the special, unique, anointed one of God. Now, so he says, you are the Messiah. You are the anointed one. And I'm not sure Peter understood what he was saying. You say, oh, yeah, he had to. No. No, I think Peter knew something about what he was saying, but I don't think Peter really understood what he was saying about Jesus. For later on, we're going to find that Peter still had a false misunderstanding of the concept of the Messiah. So Jesus is picking up on this man's expression of faith, even though this man didn't really know all that he was saying about Jesus. But he knew something what he was saying. And so Jesus picks up on this. And notice what he says to him. But he strictly warned them not to tell anybody about him, tell this about him to anybody. Why? Well, I told you this is a characteristic of Mark's gospel. It's called the Messianic Secret of Mark. And it just means that Jesus was nervous about being called the Messiah. Why? Because of the terrible political nationalistic misinterpretation of who the Messiah was going to be that developed from the close of the Old Testament canon with Malachi up until the beginning of John the Baptist's ministry. There was a whole several hundred years there. And false views began to be circulated about who the Messiah was, what he was going to do, how he was going to act. And so Jesus was afraid of these misunderstandings, misrepresentations. So he said, don't tell anybody who I am. There'll come a time when you can tell. Don't tell them now. Be quiet. Now, notice in verse 31, then he instructed them for the first time that the Son of Man had to endure great suffering and be disowned by the elders and the high priests and the scribes and be killed and rise again after 3 days. This is very important. Please look at your Bibles with me. Let's go through it phrase by phrase. Jesus knew at this time the complete outline of his life. Now I'd like to ask you the question. When did Jesus for the first time know who he was and what he was about? I ask the question merely rhetorically because nobody can answer that. But I do have a couple of opinions about it. Number one, at 12 years old, this young man understood that he had a unique, one-of-a-kind relationship with God, did he not? I mean, when your folks miss you and they find you in the temple and you tell them, didn't you know I must be about my Father's business? And he wasn't talking about Joseph, folks. And the Jews weren't accustomed to calling God Father. Not offhand like that. So, at 12 years old, he had a unique sense of who he was. Now, exactly when he understood about the cross, I don't really know, but I have an opinion again. And I think the time that he really had to struggle with the cross was the temptation experience in the wilderness right after his baptism. And we're going to find several allusions to that temptation experience right in this context here. So, I think that Jesus knew exactly what the future held. Now, friends, that is just being biblical understanding from the very beginning. For it says that Jesus Christ was pre-existent. That he was really the Lamb slain before the foundations of the world, Revelation 13:8. And so, even before he came into the world, his mission was to die for the sins of men. Now, I don't think in his development as the human side of him that he understood that until later in his life. But I want to tell you, it had always been God's plan that Jesus die in a vicarious, substitutionary way. I don't think the crucifixion was a mistake or a misfire. I think it was before the foundation of the world determined that Jesus would die for man. I think Genesis 3:15 refers to Jesus' death and resurrection. Now, notice where it says that he, the word had, it might be the word ought, it might be the word must. This is a special little word in Greek. It's the word dia. It means moral necessity. It means that Jesus in his own mind said, I have to. I must. There is no option. Must what? I must endure great suffering. Now, friends, this is what the Jew could not take. The Greeks rejected Jesus because of the resurrection. The Jews rejected Jesus because he had to suffer and die. You see, the Jews had said that Messiah was going to come on a great white horse, overthrow the Romans, set up Israel as the nation of the world. Everybody was going to flow to Jerusalem. Now, they wanted a military leader. But the Jews had never interpreted, for the most part, Isaiah 53. Or, for that matter, they never had interpreted Genesis 3:15 about the fact that the serpent would bruise the heel. And so they totally missed what God was doing because of their preconceived notions about what God was going to do. Again, let me warn you, do not limit God by your preconceived understandings of what he's going to do and how he's going to do it. Now, notice here, going to suffer great things and be, see the word disowned by the elders. Now, this word disowned, I don't know if your translation has the word disapproved. Does some have disapproved? Rejected? Anybody have something else? All those translations aren't very good, really. This is the same word that's translated most of the times, test, try, prove. It is one of the Greek words for being tested or tried. This is the Greek word that is used to mean to be tested with a view toward approval. Now, the reason they don't translate that here is that the context seems to be funny. Did the rulers test him with a view toward approval? They did. Here's what they did. They wrote down what they thought the Messiah should be. They looked at Jesus' life. Jesus did not meet their standards. Therefore, they disapproved Jesus on the fact that he did not meet their standards of who the Messiah should be. So, that is why they disowned him. They put him to the test and found him wanting. And when it says the elders, this would be the these are the doctors of theology. These are the religious interpreters. These are the commentators of the day. And then the high priests be the political religious leaders, those who are half political, half religious at this time. And then when it talks about the elders, that would be that group of elder statesmen who made civil decisions at the gates of cities. And when these three terms are used together, they refer to the makeup of the Sanhedrin. What Jesus was saying is, those who should have recognized me immediately, the highest religious authority of my day, is going to have me put to death. Well, that just wowed Peter. The ones who should have recognized it, the ones who knew their Bibles the best, are the ones who turned away. The highest, it was the Supreme Court of the Jews. And Peter couldn't believe it, neither could the other ones. Now notice what it says, after 3 days. Now you've got a misspelled thing in your outline. On number 14 in the word and phrase study, after 3 days, it's not tangum, it's the word targum, T-A-R-G-U-M. Now, those are little passages of interpretation on the Old Testament written by Jews before the New Testament era. Now, they went back to an obscure reference in Hosea chapter 6, verses 1 and 2, where, and it's real oblique, I want to tell you, it's really ambiguous, about that God is the one who breaks and heals, God's the one who tears and will put back together, and after 3 days is the context in Hosea. And I don't know what it meant in Hosea, because I don't think it's talking about, I don't think Hosea understood that to mean resurrection. I don't think he ever understood that. And I don't understand why he put 3 days in there, because I can't find any other reference in the Old Testament about 3 days. But the Jews, by Jesus' day, just like they had in Daniel 7:13, had interpreted this Hosea passage to mean something about the Messiah. And you can look up the targum, and it's so interesting that even the Jews before Jesus' day read Hosea 6, 1 and 2, and their interpretation of it is that something about the Messiah would happen in 3 days. Now that shows you that unbiased, even Jewish rabbinical interpretation of the Old Testament was much more in line with Christianity before there became a political and theological bias against Jesus in his own day, which reflected what Jews believe today. So, I think it's very interesting. This 3 days has an Old Testament reference. Jesus wasn't pulling it out of the air. Later on, in other parts of the New Testament, he says that this is related to Jonah's 3 days in the body of the whale, you see. And so, again, he's pulling something out of the Old Testament that no Jew saw the 3 days of Jonah in the body of the whale as anything even related to the Messiah. Now, notice, if you would, please, when it says, be killed, it's important to me that he knew he was going to die, and rise again. That's the greatest message in the world. It's passive tense. It means he was going to be raised by God. He's telling them plainly, I'm going to be killed, but God is going to raise me up. And they got over the top. They heard Jesus was going to die, and they closed their ears and began to pout, and the great message just went, never heard it. Never heard it. Now listen, this is what happens. Verse 32, without any reserve, and that's a pretty interpretive way of translating this Greek. It means saying all things, but it doesn't mean that Jesus told them every detail. It means that Jesus told them plainly. He didn't tell them in parables. He didn't tell them in symbolism. He didn't tell them in an ambiguous way he had been teaching the crowd. He just sat down and said to them, look, guys, I'm going to Jerusalem to die in a very few weeks and months. And after I die, I'm going to be put to death by the religious leaders in Jerusalem, the Sanhedrin. They're going to kill me, but I'm going to come back from the dead in 3 days. Now, he just put it on the line. And the tense of the verb here speaks about he was telling them. He didn't tell them once. Just as he kept telling them on the road to Caesarea Philippi district about who do people say I am, he told them over and over and over and over and over again this message about suffering, death, and resurrection. Peter couldn't buy it. Now, Peter had the best intentions in the world. But the best intentions in the world are not always God's. Peter was acting out of great love and compassion and concern in the depth of his being. But sometimes we get hurt by those who are the closest to us telling us what we know is not God's will. That's why Jesus said, if you love father or mother, you know, even the most intimate relationship in life can sometimes be the very voice of the tempter. So we've got to trust God and not what people say to us. We've got to know God's will, not what people think God's will for us is. Now notice where it says, without any reserve, he was telling them this fact. So Peter took him aside. You know, he kind of just grabbed his arm and just kind of said, I want to talk to you, man. Come over, Jesus. Took him over and said, oh, this is a shocking thing you said to us, and I'm just going to pray that God won't do it. Jesus looked him right in the eye. Peter, you are a stumbling block to me, Matthew. And Mark, it just says, Peter, you're speaking for the devil. Please don't ever say that again. You see, the same thing that Peter was saying is, this won't happen to you. You won't die. This won't ever happen to you. You won't have to suffer. Is the exact thing that Satan was tempting Jesus with in the wilderness about how to use his messianic powers. Turn the rocks to bread and feed the world. They'll make you Messiah that way. Jump off the pinnacle of the temple. Do the miraculous. Major on miracles. Wow people with sensationalism. They'll make you king that way. And then finally said, bow down and worship me and I'll give you all the world. So Peter is voicing the temptations of Satan. And Jesus recognized it. And said, get behind me. Get out of sight. So, by the way, this is the same context at Peter's call, the rock on which Jesus is going to build his church. The same paragraph that calls Peter the rock calls Peter Satan. And that's just like fallen mankind, isn't it? Just like us. Now, notice if you would please, when Jesus told them that he was going to go to Jerusalem and be killed by the Sanhedrin and rise again in 3 days, that is exactly the kind of sign that the Pharisees were asking for in the first part of this chapter. They were asking for a predictive sign based on Deuteronomy 13, 2 through 5, or Deuteronomy 18, 18 through 22, and Jesus says, you will not get it. And Jesus turns right around and gives his disciple the predictive kind of sign the Pharisees wanted, and they didn't understand what it was. I guess very significant. By the way, I read about 20 commentaries for these studies, and not one commentary saw that. So I think it's very significant that is a fact that he's giving a predictive sign. And matter of fact, this idea about this temptation with Peter being linked to the temptation experiences is something else that's not in commentaries, and I can't understand why. Now notice where in the last part of verse 33, he says to Peter, get out of my way. Yours is not from God, but from men. And then he calls the people to himself in verse 34. Now Matthew and Luke don't say that anybody's there but Jesus and the 12. Mark is the only gospel that says that there was a large crowd that followed him up into the Caesarea Philippi district. So all this was happening with a larger crowd around. But when this discussion started happening, apparently the disciples pulled Jesus off, and now he's telling the crowd, come here a minute. Come back here. And this is what he said to them. And this is one of the most startling and important things, I think, about the Christian life. This is not how to be saved. This is how to live the Christian life. Now, let's listen as we go through here. If anyone wants to be my disciple, I think the Greek is a little bit more specific. If anyone wants to come after me, okay? He must say no to self, take up the cross, put the cross on his shoulders, and keep on following me. Now, here is a beautiful example of where the Greek verb tenses help tremendously in interpreting the New Testament. I'm going to talk to Gary and Judy Kelly about me teaching a TransUnion class very soon on how you, with the purchase of about 4 or 5 books, can begin to use Greek in your own Bible study. And it'll take me 2 weeks. I'd like to do it soon, okay? Greek is the most helpful thing to interpret the New Testament with. And it's not something that's just for smart people. Friends, I wouldn't have it if that was it. It is something you can learn if you'll pay the price. And it won't take you all that long for the most significant thing. The tenses of the verbs are extremely important in Greek. The first two of these are what's called aorist imperatives. Come after me, take up your cross. Now, the aorist imperative, aorist speaks of once and... Well, here it speaks of an initiating action like take up once and for all your cross. It speaks of a complete unit of action. So he's saying, take up once and for all. Come after me once and for all. It's imperative. Imperative is the thing that means a command. He's not asking them. He's saying, take up your cross, follow me. Pow. Point action. Exclamation point. Command. Okay? But, the take up and the come after. But the keep on following is a different tense altogether. The keep on following is a present imperative. Now, if aorist means once and for all action, what does a present imperative mean in this context? We come after once and for all. We take up the cross once and for all. But we keep on following day after day. We start the Christian life with a particular decision to follow. It is point action. It's never repeated. It's once and for all. But the Christian life is a day-by-day experience after that. And so the aorist talk about the once and for all commitment. The present talks about the day-by-day following after. So, and it's put in Greek there specifically for you to see that what Jesus is demanding is an initial action, an initial decision. Decision of what? A decision to come and be his disciple, and a decision to take up the cross and follow him. Now, what did it mean, take up the cross and follow him? Jesus, it's debatable whether Jesus was crucified on a cross like that or on a T like this. But it is not, fought back and forth of which way about the fact that criminals had to carry their own cross beam. It was about a 4-6 foot large, heavy wooden beam. And their arms were already tied to that thing before they left the place where they were sentenced. And then they carried that cross, all of them did, to the place where they were executed. Now, the cross for us is a beautiful little piece of jewelry. To a Jew that was got this, to the crowd following Jesus, it was a slap in the face, a knockdown blow. What it was saying is, you have to be ready not only to be misunderstood. Folks, you didn't crucify just nice little fellas. You didn't crucify folks for jaywalking. You crucified hardened criminals. What Jesus was saying then, you have to be ready for your reputation to be shot. And not just your reputation to be shot, but you have to be willing to the point of death. Now, death, what is death how? Well, I think he's talking about physical death, but he's talking about something more as the central idea in this context. He's speaking in symbols. He's speaking in metaphors. He's saying that you have to be willing day by day to die to your self-oriented life so you may respond to a God-oriented life. Now, I am a member of a theological group called, I just call a lot of things, Deeper Life Movement, Death to Self Group, I don't know. And I have some problems with a lot of them. They think that Jesus wants you to die to your total personality. Not so. Jesus, I think, chooses us to be witnesses because every one of us has a different personality and every one of us can reach different kinds of people. God doesn't want who you are to die because I think God made who you are just as he did because he wanted someone like you. But what it does mean is that we die to a self-oriented, self-focusing, self-serving, self-dominated lifestyle. And that we orient every word, every action, every thought, every decision, we orient toward what does God want for my life in this situation. Now, I think that is as plain as it can be. If you make decisions of what's best for you without praying for God's will, you are living a self-oriented life. We have to pray for God's will in every decision, because sometimes it's God's will that we don't do the popular, beneficial, financially right kind of move. Now, notice there's two different words here he's going to start using. My translation in verse 35 has the words higher life and lower life. And yours probably has something like that too. It's the same Greek word used every time, except it uses a pronoun in its place. And it's the word psuche. We translate it soul usually, but soul is not a good translation because of our misunderstanding about the Greek concept of we have a soul and we don't. We are a soul. We don't have a soul. We are a soul. And so when it's talking about our life with this word psuche, which I think really stands from the Old Testament term, wind, breath, nephesh, that it's talking about source of life, our being, okay? And I think that's the best way to put it. So my translation begins on there in 35. Whoever wants to save his life. And I would just put life instead of higher life. I don't think there's any distinction between higher life and lower life. They all belong to God. So whoever wants to save, and I think the word himself might be very helpful. Whoever wants to save himself will have to give up himself, and whosoever gives up himself for me and the gospel will save himself. I know that's very confusing. It's just this play on words. Are you going to live a life that's beneficial to you? Are you living a life that's oriented toward what you want, what's best for you and yours, what you desire, what your plans are, what your goals are? Are you really going to lay that self-life on the altar of God and say, oh God, my life belongs to you. Whatever, whenever, wherever, however, if you'll show me clearly it's you, I'll do it. Well, that's pretty radical. Now, notice when it says, for what would it benefit a man to gain the whole world? Now, I think, again, this goes back to the temptation experience. This, to me, orients right in the middle of what Satan was saying to Jesus. He showed him all the kingdoms of the earth and said, if you'll bow down to me, I'll give you this. And Jesus is picking up on that again as another aspect of this, linking to the temptation experience and saying, what if you did gain the whole world? What if you did have every kingdom and every amount of money and everything at your disposal? What would it get you if there really is an afterlife? What does 70 years of everything this world has to offer, with no exceptions, what is that to compare to an ageless eternity without God? Well, it's like spitting in the wind in the ocean. 37. For what price can a man give to buy back life? This has got to refer to a relationship with God. What can a man give to be right with God? For whoever is ashamed of me, present, is talking about whoever is ashamed of me right now, whoever is afraid to call my name, whoever is afraid to make that decision to follow me, whoever will not give up self-life for my life, whoever is ashamed for me and my teachings in this sinful age, the Son of Man will be ashamed of him when he comes back in his Father's splendor and the holy angels. When he says he will come back in the splendor of his Father's angels, Jesus is saying by himself, I am Messiah, and I'm going to come back as judge. You see, Jesus is... I know it's getting late. I need about 10 more minutes. I'm sorry. It just went longer. He is trying to say the Jews weren't wrong in what they thought about me. What they thought about me was right, but they missed the fact that I was coming two times. Once to die for men's sins, and then coming back as judge. You see, these Jews were getting what they believed from Old Testament passages. The Old Testament passages are true, but I don't think the Old Testament saw the two comings of Jesus Christ. I think it saw just one great day. And in the way that God did it, he did it in two great days. The first coming and the second coming. So, I think he's just saying here, I'm going to come back as judge. I think it's a definite, uncompromisable reference to the second coming. I don't think it means anything else. Now, 9:1 should go with the context in 8. And that's what's going to take me about 10 minutes very quickly. 9:1 has been one of the most misunderstood passages in all the world. I had a guy to welcome me in Fort Worth and say, you know what Mark 9:1 says? I didn't, offhand, croak. No. Well, he read it to me, I won't tell you. And he said, do you think that means that there can still, that John is still alive somewhere? I thought, why? John's still alive? This man was a Kabbalah Christian, which means he was a Jewish mysticist that accepted Christ. Strange combination. Anyway, this little text has caused more misunderstanding and more conjecture, and I'm not going to settle it tonight, I want to tell you, but I want to give you the possibilities and give you my own unique interpretation that I haven't seen anywhere else either. Now, notice in 9:1 where it says, and he said to them, I solemnly say to you, some of the people standing here will certainly live to see the kingdom of God come in its power. Now, the Greek is not certainly live. The Greek is will not die or something like that. So it's talking about will not taste death is the literal rendition. Now, many folks say that taste death is an Old Testament reference for death. I promise, I just challenge you to find anywhere in the Old Testament taste the phrase taste death. It's not there. It's not used anywhere in the Old Testament. Now, here's the possibilities. Number one, because of the context, many folks think the next chapter is going to be the transfiguration experience, and Peter and James and John are going to be there, and so many think that what you're referring to is that Peter, James, and John, some who were standing there with Jesus, would see the transfiguration, Jesus' divinity, come out through his humanity, Moses, Elijah come, and so some think it's coming to the transfiguration. And I think that's a very good possibility based on the context. Okay, another one. Some think it refers to Jesus' ascension back into heaven. Some of the apostles were alive, of course, saw him ascend into heaven. Some think it refers to the fact the kingdom is already present in power. Jesus' miracles, all that he had been doing from the very beginning, had been signs and proofs that the kingdom was not going to come, but the kingdom was already here in Christ. Jesus told one group, he said, the kingdom is near to you as near as your mouth. So the kingdom was there in a sense, although it was to be consummated later. Some think, of course, it refers to the destruction of Jerusalem in A.D. 70, where the Jewish system was, I believe, judged by God in A.D. 70. Some think it refers to the second coming. Some think it refers to the rapid expanse of Christianity in the lives of the apostles, where thousands of people begin to be saved, even the priests and many others. Some think, and well, I shouldn't say some, I think, there is a real possibility, again, based upon the context, and the context is the most important tool in interpreting every individual phrase. The context here, both in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, is this ideal of dying to self-life and living to Christ's life. Could there be any possibility that instead of talking about death, in a sense of physical death, that it's talking about this complete yieldedness to the will of God for their lives? Is there any possibility that it's not talking about physical death, but this total commitment to whatever God would have them to do? I can't be dogmatic about it because there's just no way to do it. But I really feel like the context of this idea about saving your higher and lower life, this dying to self in the form of a crucifixion, saying no to self, is what Jesus is talking about when he begins this ideal about some of you standing here will understand this, the way I'd translate it, would understand exactly what I'm talking about, this orientation from self to a total orientation toward me. That's just a bonus for those who give to the cooperative program. I know it's a little late, but we'll take some time for questions and comments. Very important passages. If you have a question or comment, disagree, please. Please speak up. Yes, Terry. Yeah. What? Why did he look at the disciples, not Peter? I'm afraid the message that Peter said was overheard. And instead of looking at Peter and saying this, it was a very hard thing he's going to say about him. So instead of looking Peter right in the eyes and saying, get behind me, Satan, Peter looks at the disciples who are just... See, Peter is the spokesman for the group. And I think even what he said about this shouldn't happen to you was just voicing what the whole group felt about this deal. And so he was addressing the whole group again instead of looking into Peter's eyes, which probably would have wowed him. That's what I think. I don't know. I would like briefly for one or two of you to give me in your own words the answer to number 4 on discussion questions. Has anybody done that? Mike, I'm so glad to have you tonight. Would you summarize those verses about that in your own understanding? 34 to 38. While he's looking, has someone else done that? Thought they were rhetorical, didn't you? What do you think, Mike, if you could put it in a succinct statement? Life lived on this world's plane and life lived on the resurrection plane. Yeah, this whole context may be the key to that joyful living that Jesus kept talking about, the abundant life, the peace that passes understanding.